I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gale Rosen. This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. Night by Elie Wiesel, The Diary of Anne Frank, and the Steven Spielberg blockbuster film based on the biography of Oskar Schindler. They're all examples of works that have brought stories of remarkable courage during the Holocaust to millions of people the world over. Now, a new biography of an ordinary Polish citizen most people have never heard of may be poised to enter a new name to the list, Witold Pilecki. Joining me now in our VPR studios in Colchester is the author of that book, Jack Fairweather. He's a war correspondent who's written for The Washington Post and served as Baghdad bureau chief for The Daily Telegraph. His new book is called The Volunteer, One Man, an Underground Army, and the Secret Mission to Destroy Auschwitz. Jack Fairweather, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
Okay, Jack, let's get into this. Really amazing here. Before he became a resistance fighter for Poland, who was, in the most general sense, Witold Pilecki? What did he do for a living, for example?
Pilecki was a reserve officer in the Polish cavalry. He was also a farmer and a father of two, and he lived in eastern Poland, living a fairly unremarkable life in many ways. But for World War II, he might have lived out his days raising clover crops and running a local village cooperative in eastern Poland.
But then Hitler invades Poland in 1939. And, you know, this is not exactly a well-worn name when it comes to famous Nazi resistance figures from World War II, Witold Pilecki. How did you learn about him?
So I had been a war reporter in Iraq and Afghanistan, and a few years after leaving war zones, I was sitting with a friend trying to come to terms and talk out what we'd both experienced. And he'd just come back from reporting a story in Auschwitz, and he said, you know, I was found this story about a resistance group in the camp. And for me, it was like a lightning bolt, because Auschwitz was a symbol of the worst that man could do to man, a symbol of untold evil. Mm. And the idea that anyone could resist in the heart of the Nazis' death factory seemed stunning to me. It forced me to sort of rethink everything I knew about the camp, and in some ways everything that I knew about what we were capable of, what I'd witnessed. I mean, if you can resist in Auschwitz, what is possible? And I started reading around the subject and came across Pilecki's name, and then discovered the other remarkable thing, which was no one knew anything about the leader of this resistance movement. And there's a reason for that. He went on to fight against the communists at the end of World War II. Was executed, then executed, and then airbrushed from history and made an enemy of the state. His wartime record hidden away in the vaults. It was a crime to talk about his work, to mention his name. So for decades, his story was forgotten.
I mean, that's the short version is this guy went through an awful lot, you know, and you just jumped ahead from his time, you know, in Auschwitz to afterwards when the Soviet Union, you know, put their hooks into Poland. But I want to back up and talk about not only the fact that he resisted while in Auschwitz, he volunteered to be sent there. I mean, how did that happen?
Well, after the invasion of Poland, he helped found a resistance cell in Warsaw, one of the first to fight against the Germans. And the Germans, in the beginning of the war, they didn't have a plan to exterminate Europe's Jews. They were intent, actually, on dismantling Poland. It was the first sort of conquest of the war. And they created a concentration camp no one knew anything about, no one ever heard its name before, Auschwitz, where they were rounding up and sending hundreds and then thousands of Poles, both Jews and Catholics alike, anyone they could grab off the streets as a tool of repression and terror. And some sort of stories were emerging about the camp, but no one really knew what was happening in it. And the leader of the resistance in Warsaw wanted to find out more and approached Pilecki and said, I've got a mission for you, sir.
You know, you have to wonder, too. He's a very brave man, obviously. But if he had known what was going on in Auschwitz, you know, would he have said, OK, yeah, send me there. I'll find out what's going on and report back. Maybe he would have, maybe he wouldn't have. But as you said, they really didn't know what was going on there when he said, yeah, I'll volunteer, I'll go, I'll infiltrate.
It was still an immense struggle for him, that decision, even even knowing the small amounts that he did know, there was still the risk when he had to orchestrate his own arrest in one of these roundups, you know, which meant he sat in an apartment where he knew the Germans would be carrying out arrests, and who knew what exactly would happen. In actual fact, he delayed, perhaps understandably, quite humanly, that decision for several weeks. But eventually he took that momentous step. And extraordinarily, as I found at the beginning of my research into the book, that apartment where he sat and was arrested still exists. And perhaps even more amazingly, one of the two other people in the room that moment when the Germans burst in is still alive. He was a three-year-old boy at the time. Now he's 86 years old. And he had some extraordinary stories to tell. He remembered that moment when the Germans came for Pilecki.
We're talking with Jack Fairweather. He's the author of the new book about Witold Pilecki, a Polish resistance fighter who let himself be captured, sent to Auschwitz to gather information, organize resistance within the camp. So he is arrested. He knows he's going to be sent to Auschwitz. What was the plan, if there was one, from that point? What was he going to try and do?
His initial thought would be that he would stage a breakout attempt of the prisoners, having sort of made assessment of the situation. He arrived in the camp, and it was the brutal, terrifying induction that we are on some level familiar with from films like Schindler's List. Right. He was beaten, stripped, shaved. They were put on starvation rations, put on these terrible work gangs in the camp. And Pilecki realized that, you know, an uprising was not on the cards. Survival was the first order of business. Survival, and then, and perhaps this is an act of courage as great as the one which led him to the camp in the first place, he realized that he needed to reach out and help those prisoners around him. That was, you know, his first mission, was to try and save life in the camp.
He was a Polish resistance fighter. He was not Jewish. Was he separated from the Jewish prisoners at the camp at all? Was there any kind of a system within Auschwitz to separate the Jews from the non-Jews?
That's a great question. The original conception for the camp was for Polish political prisoners. And by Polish, that could be Jewish, it could be Catholic, it could be Protestant. Of course, it was primarily Catholic. When people were brought to the camp, there were some Jews in the transport who were singled out and put into a special penal company. But this is before the Holocaust. This is before trains carrying Jews from around Europe were specifically brought to the camp.
How long was he in Auschwitz?
For 2.5 years.
2.5 years. And during that time, was he taking notes? Was he keeping a kind of secret, running journal, if you will, of what he was finding out there?
He was at first keeping a sort of mental log. It was too dangerous to commit anything to paper. And his very first messenger from the camp, he found someone who whose family had a prisoner whose family pulled the right strings in Warsaw, and he was going to be released. So he tracked him down and gave him an oral report. And no one had ever found this oral report before, but my researcher tracked it down in London. I remember when she sort of called me up and said, you know, I found Pilecki's message from the camp. It's a message that's being discussed by the head of the RAF, by Allied commanders. And his message was this: bomb this camp. Even if you kill everyone inside it, it will be worth it. This is in October 1943, years before the Allied commanders publicly acknowledged the horrors of the camp. Pilecki was already saying, this is so bad, let's stop it now, even if we all have to die in the process.
Even if I'm still here, I'm going to die along with all these other people. This is so horrific, he was saying. You need to get rid of this camp now.
Exactly, yeah.
Did that message, do we know if that got out to the Allies, to the British leaders, to American leaders? Did they know?
The head of the RAF read this message, and we tracked down, my researcher and I, the correspondence in which they weighed up the pros and cons of attacking Auschwitz in 1940, when a million of the camp's victims were still alive.
Do we know what was discussed there? Do we know what that ledger came out to be, where they said, yes, this sounds terrible, we have this intelligence, but no, we're not going to do it because?
So what happened, the initial message that Pilecki gave came with these anecdotes and indeed some of the facts and figures he'd sort of derived about the numbers being killed in the camp, which painted a horrific picture. Bit by bit, as this report travelled secretly across occupied Europe, it got shorter and shorter until by the time it got to London, it was actually reduced to pretty much a few lines about how bad the camp was.
It's like a game of telephone where the message keeps changing until it gets to a certain end.
Right. And by losing that Pilecki's experience of the camp, it lost some of the moral imperative. So the Allied commander just looked at it as could we do it? Well, planes could just about reach there, but they didn't feel that compelling need to attack the camp that Pilecki did, and repeated again and again. But each time these messages would get a little bit thinner as they traveled.
Do we know how he managed to stay alive in the camp?
That's a great question. Partly luck, of course, yeah. Because in a camp in which by the spring of the 1941, 6 months in, over half of those who arrived in the camp with him were dead. Mm. It was luck. It was also this unerring sense of awareness and ability to spy out situations that saved Pilecki and made him such a powerful resistance fighter. A German capo, which is the name for the prisoner functionaries who ran the camp, was looking for a stove fitter just by chance. And it was a job that would be indoors. That was important, not doing the sort of back-breaking shovel work that was killing off so many prisoners. And this German ran past and said, I need a stove fitter. And Pilecki just stepped forward and said, I'm a stove fitter. Of course, he
was not, of course, right? Yeah, no idea how to fit a stove.
And that gave him those few days to sort of find his bearings in the camp and to begin the act of recruiting, because that was the other thing that helped save his life and so many other lives in the camp, was Pilecki gave them this belief that something greater could endure in the camp. He gave them the mission of resistance. Mm. And that sense that they were fighting for something was so important for those who went on to survive the camp and leave memories of Pilecki for us to discover later.
On a personal level, though, when he made that decision to let himself be arrested, he knew he'd be shipped to this camp. Maybe he didn't know quite how horrible it was. But what about his home life at the time? Was he married? Did he have a family? Were there people who were going to be just beside themselves with worry once he was sent to that camp?
His wife and two children were living in a safe house outside Warsaw. He'd gone into the camp under a false identity, so he had one sort of layer of protection. But he also knew that if he was ever interrogated, as happened periodically in the camp, some members of the resistance were brought for questioning, who knew who would crack under those circumstances. It was his life. It was the life of his wife and children that he knew he was carrying at all times.
It's remarkable. Did he escape from the camp? Was he liberated from the camp with the other prisoners when the Allies got there? How did he get out?
So Pilecki at a certain point realized that these messages that he was sending out, which, by the way, initially was with the released prisoners, but as the resistance grew in size and scope and they started assassinating SS men and sabotaging facilities, they were actually had the capacity to organize escapes to send out these messages. He eventually sort of worked out that action wasn't coming, and he felt that the best chance, indeed the only chance, for bringing about the end of the suffering in the camp was for him to personally raise a resistance force outside to attack the camp. And that meant he had to escape. And I think it's a story almost as remarkable as his entry into the camp, how he came up with the plan and executed it.
I mean, he's trying to organize an underground army, essentially.
He by 2 years into the camp, he had 1,000 men who were part of the underground. They'd worked out where the arms supplies were. They worked out a plan of attack. They were literally waiting for that word from Warsaw or from London saying, rise up. And it's excruciating to think that it's at this precise moment, of course, that the Holocaust is beginning in the camp with its full ferocity. And there was the capacity there to stop it.
So there may have been. Let's get an idea about that, because you're mentioning an important timeline here, because, as you say, when he gets first sent to Auschwitz, it's a camp. Nobody really knows what's going on there. It slowly becomes something more than a concentration camp, more than a place to keep resistance people. It becomes this place which is really a death camp. I mean, how did that evolve over time, and where was Paleczki's place in that timeline?
So Paleczki was witnessing over this 2 year period the steps by which the Nazis arrived at the final solution. It was through experimentation, bit by bit, they established the moral logic and indeed the technological capacity to kill large numbers of people. And it began with euthanizing sick patients of the camp hospital, and then they sort of worked out how to start gassing Soviet POWs who arrived in 1941, and eventually devised the death factory, these large sort of industrial facilities for gassing and burning the bodies of Jewish arrivals. And Paleczki had this extraordinary task, because although we know the Holocaust, we know what the Nazis, where they reached in their thinking, Paleczki did not. This was all totally unprecedented to him. He had to somehow work out what the Nazis were up to, even as the Nazis themselves were discovering this logic, this genocidal thinking. And for me, it was, you know, as a reporter, I recognize in Paleczki this, you know, this great sort of detective work that he had to do. I mean, he was stealing reports and sort of poring over them, trying to work it out. He sometimes sent out reports he was constantly trying to rationalize and sometimes reach the wrong conclusion as to what the Nazis were doing. The first time Jewish families were brought to the camp to be gassed, he thought it was in order to rob them and plunder their wealth. He couldn't realize that it was because they were Jews that they were being
just summarily put to death.
They were put to death, yeah.
In the worst ways. I mean, just to see that unfold and that slow realization he must have had, as you say, like a detective, like a reporter, but then not just discovering documents and things, but this really methodical horror. I just can't imagine must have been going on inside his head as he's realizing this, trying to keep his cool at the same time, trying to get news out about all of this. We're talking this hour with Jack Fairweather, an author and former war correspondent for The Washington Post and The Daily Telegraph. He's written a new book. It's called The Volunteer, One Man, an Underground Army, and the Secret Mission to Destroy Auschwitz. It's all about the Polish resistance fighter Witold Paleczki. Jack, I want to talk a little bit about Paleczki himself, because what's great about this book is that you tell us this remarkable story about this man who was inside Auschwitz trying to get information out to the Allies. But the man himself is very interesting as well. As you said, ordinary Polish citizen, a farmer, a guy who very much loved his country. And I don't want to, you know, paint the wrong picture of him. He was doing heroic things. But let's put it this way. He was not doing what he did to save the Jews. This was not his main thing. Why was he so insistent on putting himself in such grave danger to get to Auschwitz to do something to fight back against Hitler?
I think Paleczki had a vision for Poland that distinguished him from some others in the underground. In fact, one of the reasons why he was volunteered for the mission, why it was presented to him, was because he got into an argument with his commander in the underground, who wanted to take his organization in a more sort of nationalistic, narrowly Catholic and Polish direction. And Paleczki was like, no, we have to broaden our appeal. Anyone who wants to fight the Nazis is on our side. Mm. Let's not be narrow about this. His commander wasn't very pleased with Paletsky.
This was the enemy of our enemy is our friend kind of thing.
Yeah. Yes. And the commander, said, well, I'm going to got a mission for you then. How are we going to Auschwitz? So there's this interesting sort of backstory that sort of, there's the prelude to this story that I think really shows Paletsky's political motivations. He was a humanitarian and a centrist, and he was someone who recognized in the suffering around him certain essential values. He saw that the Nazis were trying to atomize and break people apart and label them according to their ethnicity. And I think on some profound level that he responded against that. He saw it as part of his mission to lean into the suffering of others and try and publicize and spread the word and not fall into the Nazis' trap of falling into tribalism or into petty squabbles with others.
Is it fair to say that he was nationalistic in some sense, and that he had this great love for his native country, was not only angry, upset, but offended on some level too that his country was invaded, taken over by Germany?
I would say for sure he was a patriot in the positive sense of that word, that he saw a set of values that Poland represented and wanted to would fight for that country, at the risk of his life, his family's life, and everything he held dear. I mean, he was a patriot, I think, rather than a nationalist. And I think that's an important distinction that connects in some ways with where we find ourselves today.
And we're going to talk about that in a little bit in a moment, too. Right now, we've got a call on the line. Dave is on the line from Rockingham. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good afternoon. My dad was in the FBI and counterintelligence during World War II. They were chasing, the Germans were landing submarines off the coast of Long Island, so he was in one of the heads of that operation. But later he was reminiscing, and he said that Roosevelt knew about these concentration camps, but that General Eisenhower felt that the war, since it was not going the way it should have gone, he wanted to prosecute the war before even bombing those camps. And he wanted the use of the Air Force. And of course, at that time, our Air Force was just starting to really build up to enormous, we were going from 3 planes a month at the beginning of the war to 3,000 a month. So it was, that was my own research on that. And I asked him about that, and he said, no, they wanted to help, they wanted to destroy the German army. They did not want to go after these camps.
Very interesting story, Dave. Thank you for that call from Rockingham. Does that jibe with what your research has shown, Jack, that there was this intelligence here, but there were differing opinions, like General Eisenhower thinking, no, we can't do this right now. We've got to stick with our plan for the war.
I think that is one of the crucial reasons why, or some might say excuse, that the Allied commanders had. They've got to win the war first. They'll deal with Nazi atrocities after the war. And I think that was the struggle that people like Paletsky and other first alerters faced, was trying to persuade folks far away from these atrocities that, no, this is something that has to be dealt with now. And while, whilst those commanders won that argument, I think now, looking back with the benefit of history, we'd say that, in actual fact, Paletsky and these alerters were right, that there was a moral duty to intervene. And that's one of the takeaways from World War II, and I suppose how we sort of try and make amends for that error.
Yeah, and it must have been difficult for him, I imagine. He can't possibly know what effect his words, or how much of his information, is even getting out, right, to the Allies. I mean, was there any way for him to know, when he did was able to get information out of the camp, that it was getting to the right ears?
Well, in 2 years into his time in the camp, a member of the underground headquarters was arrested and brought to Auschwitz, and he tracked Paletsky down. And Paletsky said, so what about my reports about the gassings, about the injections, about the mass murder? And the guy said, well, we're not really center of our attention up in Warsaw, sorry. And, you know, Paletsky was standing with some of his men at the time, and he describes it like getting punched in the stomach. And that was the beginning, in some way, of the realization that he had to escape. But I think it was also the beginning of this deeper sense of guilt that haunted him for the rest of his life, that he hadn't done enough, that there should have been more that he could do. And, you know, he was haunted when he left the camp by survivor's guilt, I guess we would call it now.
We have Gene on the line from Randolph. Hi, Gene, you're on with Jack Fairweather.
Hi, Jack, I just wanted to thank you so much for writing the book to begin with. I've read about the French resistance during the war, but I've always wondered about the Polish resistance. My own family's heritage is from that part of Poland, and I always wondered, what about them? So this is fascinating for me. I did have a question about his, you mentioned he had two children, and I was curious if you've learned anything about the two children.
That's a great question. In fact, that was my first question in beginning the research was, you know, where are his kids? I felt that, you know, I needed to get their permission to write about their dad. And so on my first trip to Warsaw in 2016, Andrzej Paletsky, the son, was the first person I called on somewhat nervously to see whether he was 86 years old. And as it turned out, I shouldn't have been so nervous because he was just a delightful man. And his story of, he only discovered what his dad did in the camp to a certain level in the 1990s. He lived, you know, 50 wow. odd years, only know, I mean, he knew his dad was in Auschwitz, but not that he was this incredible war hero and this mission that he was on. And so the last 10 years or so, as some of this research, at least in Poland, has emerged, it's been this amazing moment for him to connect his memory of his dad with, you know, with the stories that he now knows about his time in the camp.
I think we have a fellow author who would like to speak with you now from one Jack to another. Jack Mayer is on the line. He's the author of Life in a Jar. Hi, Jack. You're on with Jack Fairweather.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a question about Jan Karski, who I wrote Life in a Jar about Irena Sendler, and she was the connection, or one of the connections, with Jan Karski about the Warsaw Ghetto, and then Jan Karski got the information to FDR in 1942. I think that was the winter of 1942. So I wonder if there was any connection between the two of them, from the camp to Jan Karski.
That's a great question. In fact, there was a new courier whose name was also rather lost to history, who became the key interlocutor for Paletsky's reports. He was a man called Napoleon Segieda, and he parachuted into Poland, a British-trained operative, and was sent to Auschwitz to sort of check out what Paletsky was reporting on. And Paletsky managed to smuggle out a message to him. And then he traveled over many months back to London. He thought he was going to be back in London before Karski. He was aware of Karski's own mission.
Jan Karski, we should say, was a Polish resistance fighter as well.
Yes, an incredible witness to what happened in the ghetto and a way station to one of the death camps in Belzec. So a very powerful voice attesting to what the Nazis were up to. So Karski arrived before this courier, and this courier, he was delayed and detained and ended up in a Spanish concentration camp that he had to escape from. And it meant that the crucial message that he had, that Auschwitz was the center of the Holocaust, was not delivered until, you know, well into 1943. Mm. And so Karski wasn't able to take that information with him to the US, wasn't able to present it to FDR. So it's, you know, ships passing in the night, unfortunately. Yeah.
You know, you alluded to this at the beginning, Jack, but I want to get into it a little bit more now. Paletsky's troubles, if his life hadn't been difficult enough to that point, did not end with the end of the war. It did not end when he escaped from the camp. The Soviet Union soon established its own brand of control over Poland, and Paletsky now finds himself imprisoned yet again, this time not by design. What happened?
he went at the end of the war. He escaped from the camp, fought in the Warsaw Uprising, and then at the end of the war went back to Warsaw to arrange resistance against the Russian occupation. He was betrayed after about a year of operations and brutally interrogated over 7 or 8 months. A lot of the interviews that were conducted with him have survived, and you get a sort of sense from the transcripts of the just how.
Well,
when you say
brutally, you have a quote from Vitold in the book that says Auschwitz was just a game compared to this.
Right.
That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it's I mean, he was very savagely beaten, and I think, you know, he also passed on at the trial. He passed on a message to his wife, who was allowed to come and approach the box every once in a while. He said, you know, I want this to end quickly.
And was this just because the Soviet Union wanted control of the narrative about them being sort of the resistance fighters who fought back against the Nazis, and they didn't want him, the Polish resistance, claiming this? I mean, why were they so intent on imprisoning him and eventually executing him?
Well, a lot of Eastern Europe that came under Soviet control had been collaborators with the Nazi regime, so it was quite easy for the Soviets to come along and say, right, we're kicking out the Nazi collaborators, you know, and now this is the future. Of course, in Poland, they've been viciously, bravely fighting against the Nazis for the whole war, so they couldn't impose that narrative. So what they had to do was round up men like Pilecki and imprison them. And they came up with this convoluted story about how Pilecki was a sort of agent of fascism and imperialism, and I think a lot of the trauma that Poland experiences today comes from the fact that the stories of men like Pilecki were buried, that this wartime record of resistance was illegal to discuss, was dangerous, and was buried for 50 years.
Well, I do want to bring up something about today, because just this week, President Trump met with the president of Poland. Now, Poland's increasingly right-wing government has actually made it a crime to impute any Polish responsibility for the Holocaust. They have walked back a bit. But Pilecki has been adopted as a kind of nationalist symbol. I mean, what do you think he would think about all this?
Well, I know what his son thinks, and he does is disturbed by the politicization of Pilecki's legacy. I mean, I think, as we discussed, Pilecki himself was apolitical. He didn't want the underground to go down that route. So I suspect that he would have urged urge people to try and come together around a common good, not try and divide the nation according to political views, that's for sure.
He didn't live long enough, I suppose, to ever have met some of the people that may have gotten out of the camps. He's tied to this story so much. And I mentioned before about, his duty to his country, his love of Poland. He was not Jewish himself. Do you think, or from talking to his kids, did he identify in any way with the suffering of the Jews and what he tried to do to help, even if he wasn't ultimately successful?
I think it comes across in a couple of the reports that he wrote after the war, and he says, you can feel his emotion as he writes about how people were brought like cattle to the slaughter in the camp. This letter that he smuggled out of the camp, you know, the shock and the horror of what he's witnessing really comes through. He never, you mentioned Elie Wiesel at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one of the tragedies of Pilecki's story is that when he was executed, he was still processing this experience. He never had the decades to come to terms with what he had seen. You see him struggling to understand Auschwitz. And if he had lived for longer and had lived in a free country, I think he would have told us many more things. going forwards.
Well, maybe his remarkable story now will finally come out in the way that it's been told in your book. Jack Fairweather lives in Charlotte, Vermont. He's a war correspondent who's written for The Washington Post. He was Baghdad bureau chief for The Daily Telegraph. And his new book about Vitold Pilecki is called The Volunteer, One Man, an Underground Army, and the Secret Mission to Destroy Auschwitz. It'll be out on June 25th. Jack Fairweather, thank you so much for taking the time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Richard.